Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, we are joined by Grant Greenwell, SIMSEC Director of Operations, and Chris Barber, SIMSEC Director of Membership, to talk about cybersecurity, the Samwell Destroyer, amphibious operations, force planning, and Matt gets accused of waffling. As a friendly reminder, you are our best advertiser. Subscribe and tell a friend about our podcast available on iTunes and Xbox Music. Leave us a comment and a rating as well. We think it's a very fine product and hope you do too. Now, without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to this week's episode of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am your host, Matthew Hipple, and I'm joined here today by fellow SIMSEC members Grant Greenwell and Chris Barber. Welcome, guys.
Well, hello. Nice to speak to you.
Grant, Chris, Grant, you go first. I'll let you go ahead and introduce yourself.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot for having us aboard and facilitating this, and ahoy to all of our listeners out there from Newport, Rhode Island. Grant Greenwell, I'm your Director of Operations. Very proud to be so. A lot of great things going on in SIMSEC. Perhaps the most exciting for this weekend, however, is the three of us getting together to talk about some really awesome things. Brief background on me. Surface Warfare Officer for the Navy. Started my naval career when I was 11 with U.S. Naval Sea Cadet Corps, and loving every single second of it. And I'll defer now to Chris Barber, who's part of the real Corps. Over to you, Chris.
Hey, Semper Fi, acting on Verba. Chris Barber here, Marine Corps Captain. Did a few years on active duty, got out, and then went right into the reserves and mobilized in the reserves, currently working in the National Capital Region. 2008 United States Merchant Marine Academy grad, so I have kind of feet in different worlds of the maritime spheres. And I'm super excited to be here and super excited to be part of the organization I think's doing some of the most cutting-edge thinking regarding maritime security matters. And I'm also the director of membership for SIMSEC. So please, everyone listening, put in a application and let's get you on board so we can add to the conversation.
Absolutely. You know what, guys? We started off right before the podcast here. It sounds like we had some juices flowing. Cybersecurity, purpose of intelligence services. Let's start off with that. Grant, you were talking about you went to a conference. Maybe you could describe that, what you heard.
Okay, great. Thanks. I was really privileged this weekend to head on up to Tufts in Boston and pretend that I was a student at the Fletcher School for all of Saturday. And there were two different scenarios and simulations that were going on. The first was a educator forum where they had cybersecurity experts embedded at Fletcher teaching educators in the Boston city for grades 6 through 12. And they were walking them through how to explain to their high school students just what is cybersecurity, what is the importance, what's going on in the news, how to react to it, et cetera. At the same time, they had graduate-level students at Fletcher, and they've just kind of kickstarted their new cybersecurity arena under Professor Martell there. But they had them running a scenario where you had 12 or 13 different government agencies, and one or two of them were drastically impacted by a virus or a hacker and was pretty much taken completely offline. And one thing that will hit home to all of us here is that it was the Veterans Administration. So they completely took out the Veterans Administration, and they were looking to see three things. First, what was the impact across the rest of federal government? Two, what was the impact to the populace? And then three, how do you recover from something like that? And it was really great to see, for the first part, for the educators, kind of what's the difference between what they see and perhaps what those of us involved in maritime security see on a day-to-day basis. Not even talking about releasability or anything like that, but, if you talk to the general populace and the educators, what we basically saw was the only thing that they knew for the past 10 years for cybersecurity issues were Edward Snowden, and that was it. Versus if you ask, any of the three of us or any of our listeners, we probably would have said Russia and Estonia, Russia and Georgia, maybe Stuxnet, something like that. And it was interesting to see those thoughts portrayed in the simulation as well, where they were looking to see, hey, was this a small-time attack? Was it hacktivist? Was it a denial of service from another state entity? So a lot of good things going up there at Fletcher that we can talk about.
Well, I'd almost say it's unfair to say maybe people don't have such a large amount of exposure. Maybe it's just our attention span, because you brought it up yourself. You brought up Stuxnet. You brought up Estonia. I feel like people hear these things. It's a difference between hearing and listening, and maybe that's our problem. The problem isn't that we're not exposed to it and we don't pay attention to it, but once you hear about it, the millionth denial of service attack on a government website or whatever whatever it happens to be, is it assumed to be part of the background noise? But maybe it's just that people don't realize or don't appreciate what it is that they're seeing. Maybe one of you guys have thoughts on that.
Yeah, so to kind of caveat off that and maybe launch in a little bit, my issue with the recent Cybermania, if you want to describe it, is as we talked about, hey, is it the attention span or is it this? Well, I think it's a larger issue in general currently in American society, but you know, literally and figuratively, we're fat people that still want to eat their cake, but not be fat. And so as of that, what I mean by that is it pertains to the, you know, what I mean by that is it pertains to this recent scandal is, you know, it's healthy to have a discussion about where intelligence should rest within the spectrum of our republic. But when we start precluding things like, hey, this was a foreign leader that was collected upon, that's what intelligence agencies do. And if we're not comfortable with that as Americans, that's okay. But let's examine the assumptions and the preconditions and say, you know, what do we want them to do then, and understand the limitations and constraints. And I do think with Grant's point is, you know, as it comes up with Snowden, it's this, you know, made for Hollywood story, you know, that's getting a bit of lionization in the media. And nobody's asking the questions, well, what do we want these different entities and agencies to be doing there? It's, you know, intelligence as defined is gaining information for decision makers. And, if we don't want that information for decision makers, that's fine. If we do want that information, let's have a discussion about what we think's the right way to go about it, do it, but let's not polarize it and moralize it to the point that we've already assigned blame, I think, without examining what the conditions were that we went through to get there. I don't know if that made sense. So that,
you know, it does make sense. This goes into the early bird almost when you talk about who is the one that's making this an issue. And when they talked about why they got rid of the early bird, they said, well, there's a 24-hour news cycle. Does this really speak to the way that news is communicated nowadays? Is it really something that's necessary? I would almost argue that that logic ignores the fact that the 24-hour news cycle has warped the way we ingest news, is that you look at the Edward Snowden thing. Do the American people have a problem if we did indeed spy on any of these leaders? I don't think they do, but I think the issue becomes, well, the news has nothing to talk about. So you look at something like the early bird, and you say, this is a good idea. Why? Because, in fact, the 24-hour news cycle has put so much garbage into the system, there's no way for me to, on a daily basis, in a professional manner, go into the vast sea of garbage and pull out the important points. And the same thing goes for the Snowden issue, is you look at security professionals, or you look at people who are just amateurs in the military, or just civilians that are out there looking for pieces of information on how their national security strategy exists and how it functions and how their intelligence agencies function, is that there's not a lot, unless they're going to go into the academic routes. The academia, if you want to call it that, in the news is so bad because it's not out there to inform you. It's not guys like, I think Crumpton, his book, which is an excellent piece, but it's just a bunch of amateurs or people who literally know nothing just talking about stuff, maybe two or three bullet points that they heard. So go ahead.
I think that's spot on. I think though the media's job is not, I don't view it as the media's job to present the fair and balanced or the equal sides of the equation. That's fine. The media is going to do what they're going to do because they are their own incentives and motivations. I think what I haven't seen though is that point of, hey, this is what intelligence agencies do by law, by design. I haven't seen anybody in government put that out and discuss that because we're almost taking the line of, uh-oh, we got caught with our hand in the cookie jar. Let's act appropriately sullen. And I'm saying that's
an interesting point.
That's not
a really, yeah.
And you know,
go ahead, Grant.
And you know, Chris, I mean, you kind of, you know, hit the nail on the head with the hammer right there as far as, you know, who has come out and said, hey, you know, we'd rather have these services and this is the way that it should be. Would you not like the alternative? Would you like the alternative? And surprisingly enough, a man who, I respect enough to read, you know, Ambassador Bolton, to the UN, came out, about 3 months ago with an article in the Washington Post saying, hey, you know, there's only so much that you guys can see as a populace. You're only seeing literally the top 1 to 5% of what is actually happening. And you have to have faith and trust that we're trying to do the right thing. What do you guys think about that as far as a blanket trust statement issued for our fellow government employees, there in Fort Meade?
I don't think the American people have to prescribe to the have faith and trust because, you know, our republic is set up as a, you know, counterbalancing forces that don't believe in trust as a basic of human nature. And I think that's a good thing. But I think, so it's okay to have the oversight and it's okay to have the questions. The part I don't like is where, you know, the people with their hand in the cookie jar, so to speak, whoever the NSA or these different agencies, there's no forceful kind of narrative coming out of government of saying, listen, this is what they do. We're not going to railroad anyone. And we're not going to say that they're not doing their jobs or they've done something wrong. We'll perform the appropriate oversight. Here's the oversight that we have and lay that out. And I think that would take a lot of the air out of the sails of these kind of very polemic statements that are getting made on the MSNBCs, Foxes, and that 24-hour media cycle of saying, like, listen, people, this is what, you know, these are the, let's not forget, the people that are yelling and screaming about Snowden are the same people that were yelling and screaming during the 9/11 commission report about not enough being done. So I think that we should probably square that circle and at least approach it that from the side of the house that is conducting this or, you know, responsible for this should put that piece of the argument out there. That's my opinion.
Now, that's a good point. And maybe it speaks to, I don't want to say it's a trend, but there is a point where you don't have to be defensive about everything. You can't please all the people all the time, especially, you know, guys working in the Navy, officers, leadership can understand that. You're never going to please everyone. Everyone is not going to be happy. You have to prioritize. So, yes, someone's not going to be happy that you're spying on people. People don't like being spied on. But when it comes to spying on people who are abroad, when it comes to people who aren't American nationals, and it comes to people who are perhaps associating with folks that are abroad, that's what the intelligence agencies were invented for. This is why they exist. This is their founding tenets. It is the enemies abroad is why the intelligence agencies exist. And to go on the defensive almost seems at some points inappropriate, and it just seems silly too, because it's pedantic. Nobody thinks the Germans don't spy on anyone. No one thinks the Brits and or the Mexicans don't. All these people, they're acting, oh, I have no idea what you're talking to. 100% have their own intelligence agencies, and they're doing the same thing. But I think maybe this isn't so much of an issue where it's people are shocked, but people are acting shocked because they know that it's going to get them some political points. But that's just my perspective. I mean, that's the nature of the international system. If you can gain yourself some political capital, you do it. Whether or not the honest answer is, okay, you got caught, but you know what? I know I do the exact same thing. You're using that Machiavellian, I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't do this. I am pure from these kinds of activities, even though objectively everybody knows that, that you're not.
Yeah, no, I agree. I just pushed over the chat room the story on Eva Montes, which if nobody's familiar, it was a very famous spy case of a Cuban penetration. And I think things like that would be a good counterbalance for maybe the government to show like, listen, folks, this is something that's always going to happen. We should talk about it in as non-emotional terms as we can. There is no reason the American people give up the right to oversight and give up the right to understand the processes going on. And that is something that's vital. But again, the hand in the cookie jar syndrome that I just don't understand why there hasn't been a better narrative pushed out from the government side of the house really bothers me. And more so to the point, I don't know if you guys saw the South Park episode, I think 2-3 weeks ago, the one that kind of brought on the scandal. I would highly recommend it because it brings up the other great point of you can't really get too mad when you're giving all this stuff up for free to Google and Apple and everyone else. It's not to say that it's exactly in the same Venn diagram and that you know, but it was a very good, as South Park always does, a very good and very humorous take on some of the hypocrisy of the people that are yelling the loudest about this.
You know, and Chris, somebody mentioned a really good, I guess, anecdote that is analogous to all this. You know, when you're on your iPad or your Mac or a computer, you know, do you guys ever get upset when there's an update required all of a sudden to your computer for security purposes? Yeah, it's a little annoying, a little disappointing that, you know, maybe somebody was able to infiltrate the system. But at the same time, it means that people were doing their job and being proactive and protecting your system and your security. I think kind of the same thing applies here.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you can't yell at the fireman when he goes by and sees the gas can and the lit matches right next to it on your front lawn and says, "Put that out." You know, he's just doing his job. So I think that's, and again, we can say, "Oh, this is so horrible what these people are doing. It's yada yada yada." Let me not read this Apple security agreement that says that they retain their rights.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the same exact thing. So we're a bunch of fat people that want to keep on eating cake, but stay thin.
Well, that's what stomach stapling's for, right? We just need to find whatever policy that is that would work. I don't know how to turn that into an intelligence equivalent, but.
Well, at least we should probably stop referring to ourselves as fat and stapling because we're probably ostracizing a lot of our members in the Beltway.
Well, hey, come on now. Hey, I'm at least in the Northern Virginia area. I'm not portly, but okay. Come on now. All right. Well, beyond beating cybersecurity and intelligence to death, some that I brought up, I shot through the chat line here. I don't think some folks had read Bad BIOS article that I've been reading up on. I guess it's a computer virus that communicates to other infected computers and rebuilds their data. If they're being attacked, it rebuilds those databases through ultrasonic sound, which is pretty cool. I think Grant was mentioning to me in the chat that he hadn't read it. Chris, I don't know if you'd taken a look at it.
Yeah, I'm browsing it right now.
But
it's a good
topic for later. Maybe another podcast or an article sometime. But for everyone listening, you know, if you're interested in cybersecurity, that's something that's popped up that's pretty intriguing and kind of terrifying. But you know, if you turn off your microphone and speakers, you'll probably be saved. All right. So this week, the Zumwalt came out. For a guy like me, that's kind of a big deal because I'm a huge fan of Elmo Zumwalt. Although I kind of feel like the guy who brought systems analysis into the Navy would have vomited if he took a look and saw the ship that they have named after him. My view of it is incredibly awesome and devastatingly pointless, but maybe that's just me. It's a huge stealth battle boat that's got a gun. At least, maybe it's just me, but I do not see it fitting into a cohesive idea of what the battle space will look like, especially with issues of area denial and small boat attacks. It seems very, minus the stealth aspect, it would be vulnerable to those kinds of attacks. I don't know. What are your guys' view on this massive new project we've just rolled out?
I'm going to jump in before Chris because I'm going to say something a little bit controversial that he'll have to respond to, I'm sure, being a Marine Corps component member. I think, like you said, it is a worthless ship. Outside of being able to test new technologies, it really doesn't have a role for any part of our national maritime strategy. You know, it is not built for area air defense. It can maybe do a little bit of point defense and maybe ship-to-ship defense, but nowhere near any of our Aegis-class destroyers or cruisers. It does not do, outside of perhaps Tomahawk, any kind of land attack. Its guns are not going to be able to reach inshore like they should because they just don't have the munitions for it. And quite frankly, the only reason why they're there is to support the Marine Corps. Outside of that, you know, they don't really have a mission.
Chris?
Back on here. Sorry, I was trying to find something online. So you guys are the SMEs. I will probably push myself into some retarded corner that I can't get out of because I don't have the technical knowledge that you guys do. But my quick take on it is I probably would agree with you more there, Grant, from what I've read on it and my limited knowledge of naval architecture and shipboard operations coming from the more merchant marine side of the house from college. So what I don't understand with the Zumwalt and what it seems to be we're doing repeatedly with large kind of weapon system development is why did we throw out the iterative small baby steps process to developing these systems? And we decided that we're going to draw a blank slate, throw a ton of money down an alleyway that we don't know where it ends up and hope for the best. And that seems to be what we're doing with Zumwalt, JSF, LCA. I mean, take your pick of any major in-item platform. And there's a lot of things we could talk about with regards to that. It could be the kind of the faults of the joint acquisition systems, post-Goldwater Nichols. It could be a lot of different things. But that's one concern I have that I know guys like Commander Salamander have brought up. Why are we not taking a much more iterative and kind of practical, you know, little bit of change, very consistently applied approach to this stuff? And then secondly, what are we looking to do in terms of, you know, I hear all this stuff of, hey, we need to be good in the littorals. We're facing, you know, these asymmetric threats in the weird places. But don't worry, we're going to have a major Mahanian naval engagement against the Chinese. So we need these large. So, again, it's probably more of an American problem than it is just, you know, a Navy problem or a Zumwalt problem that we can't seem to get that schizophrenia that we have inherent settled. I do think, you know, from the Marine Corps side of the house, the Navy has completely disregarded naval surface fires as a supporting arm. And I do like that the Zumwalt at least tries to pay lip service to that. But I think that, you know, the blame rests on two sides. The Marine Corps certainly didn't yell loud enough about that. And then B, we've been involved in a lot of wars where naval surface fires have not really been able to be applied outside of, you know, TLAMs and stuff like that. So I think that, I think it probably tries to do some good things, but it seems like we're taking a huge gamble on a system that we won't be able to really prove until it's too late.
When it was conceived, the idea of having a stealth, it's essentially the Comanche of ships. Now, I loved the Comanche. I thought it was the coolest thing on the planet. A stealth helicopter that can do loop-de-loops in the air, that's amazing. But
every 12-year-old loves the Comanche.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm sure when you saw it, you probably played it as I did in some video game when we were 8. So
yeah, I was like, this is so cool. Why? And then Secretary Rumsfeld broke my heart because he got rid of it. And I was like, no, why? It's so cool. You have this thing. It's cool. But it served no purpose. And it probably is for the best that we're not spending all that money on a Comanche. When it comes to naval surface fires, though, I really do think that when it comes to supporting the Marines on the beach is that we've taken a lot of that away because we look at aviation. Marine and Navy aviation as the answer to that question. It, of course, they don't have the, it's the difference between rate of fire and sorties, but really it's still the same equation. It's a little slower to sortie out aircraft, but when aircraft are on station, it's possibly a faster reaction, but of course you would know that better than I do. But if you've got close air support on station, it's probably a lot faster than trying to get word to the guns over on the water to hit, you know, what do you call them? Grid squares. You're going to hit the grid square. Well, the pilot can see that you're sitting in that grid square and it's probably not the right one. Whereas the guy on the ship.
You want to hit a grid square. That would be dangerous. That's a 1K by 1K area. So I don't know if I'd want to call fire in on that.
All right. Well, see, there you go. That's what I'm talking about. You're the SME when it comes to surface fires.
You bring up a good point because that you are exactly spot on. Is that's the choice? I think explicitly and implicitly, the Marine Corps and the Navy. It's blame is to assign to both have made that like, oh, we don't need this stuff. We're gonna, you know, rely on, you know, this really nice aviation component to do that and maybe some UAVs and maybe, you know, some cruise missiles. The problem with that is if we're gonna be a combined arms force, which the Marine Corps proclaims itself to be and the Navy, I think would also, proclaim itself to be, it doesn't serve a combined arms force well to take away its diversity and to say, we're going to take this out of our kit bag and we're going to rely on this. That's really just against all the doctrine and all the theory that you would want to have in a combined arms force. You want to have multiple different systems and applications that you can throw at a problem, not fewer. And if we, you know, if we assign the future of never using surface fires, then that's a future we'll create for ourselves, and there will be a situation in which we will need to use them, because technically and tactically, there's times, you know, it's all what we call METT dependent in the Marine Corps, situation dependent. And there's going to be times where that gun's going to be faster, where the plane's going to be faster, one's going to be better. An artist doesn't want to limit the paintbrushes in his, you know, I don't even know what an artist calls what he puts his paintbrushes in, but he doesn't want to take a paintbrush away.
A cup?
A cup, I guess. I don't know if there's some sexier term for it, but.
I think it's just a paintbrush cup, but. Yeah. I'm also not an artist.
But you know,
Sorry.
No, go ahead, Chris.
No, I was done.
I had this exact same discussion with one of your alma mater's graduates, class 79 grad, who commanded MSC. And, you know, I said, hey, we don't even really need an amphibious capability. You know, what is the use of a 33, 36, you know, ship force for amphibious capability? Definitely don't need it. We're never going to do that kind of style invasion ever again. And he made a really, really good point to me. He had me draw out the cost of, one, getting rid of the force, and then, two, ramping back up the force in under 90 days. And so I definitely see now why there is an importance to sustaining that capability, especially because, you know, there's only a handful of us around the world who actually have the ability to do that.
You know, it's a good point. Chris mentioned Mahan. Capabilities can be in being. If you have an amphibious option, your enemy has to defend against an amphibious option. And this could be my incorrect memory of history here, but I think in the first Desert Storm they talked about an amphibious assault, and the Iraqis were getting ready for that amphibious assault, and bam, the army comes in and the Marines come in across the desert, but part of that defense was aimed towards the shore, where if they knew for a fact it wasn't a capability, even if we weren't going to use it, the fact that you have a fleet in being or a capability just in general in being means that your enemy has to stay off guard. That OODA loop, his ability to orient after observing, is decreased. He has to spread his resources a lot more thin. So a lot of the folks that talk about, oh, let's just combine them all, or we don't need an amphibious capability, makes the calculations of your enemies a lot easier, because they can say, well, I don't have to look out for this, I don't have to look out for that, and now I know exactly where my enemy is going to come from.
You're spot on, Matt, and that's that was five divisions worth of Iraqis that was distracted by some well-placed news reports and a few SEALs on the beach making a lot of noise. I mean, that's a huge amount of combat power that who knows how that would have altered the calculus of the left hook and Schwarzkopf going across the desert. And to your point, Grant, you know, I believe you're talking about, Admiral Busby, a very famous Kings Point grad.
I am.
And you have just the cost alone, like you said, capabilities are not to be wished for at the outset of hostilities. Mm-hmm. And to do so is to, you know, how much risk are you willing to assume? And let's put that risk in dollar amounts, and let's put it in live amounts in terms of, you know, how many people are going to die, which is the kind of, in my mind, the no S Sherlock statement. If we wish away, if we say we don't need these capabilities, and we have plenty of historical precedent, you know, no, I think 2 years before Inchon, 2 or 3 years before Inchon, Omar Bradley saying America's never going to do another amphibious landing. So it's something, and that's why I do believe in a joint force that is distinct, and separate in its service identities, because it allows you the flexibility and the different, you know, not only capabilities, but modes of thought to approach problems. And once we start saying, nah, this is the way it's going to go, everything's going to be, some type of, air sea battle strike, this is how the future of war is going to look like. It's a fool's errand to say that, because you're making a bet on the future, and if you're wrong, you've got a lot more risk to assume than if you're right.
You know, let me, I think actually hit on a point that might explain the justification for the Zumwalt. I think Ray Pritchard over at Information Dissemination, he was mentioning how the Zumwalt is essentially the HMS Dreadnought, where it was obsolete before it came out, but it was still necessary. Yes, it's a mess to the people like us that are looking boots on the ground or boots hovering slightly above the water at the problems that we face, but if we do that iterative method of procurement where we always move up by small increases, all we would have today is really awesome sales instead of new methods of propulsion like steam or nuclear or diesels. Is the Zumwalt itself is a mess, but objectively so was the Monitor. I mean, the Monitor had all sorts of problems during the Civil War, but it worked for what it was planned for. Now, I'm not saying the Zumwalt is by any stretch of the imagination as well thought out and executed as the Monitor was, because the Monitor was for a very specific mission, but it is in that realm. Is someone sat down and said, here's a bunch of new technologies, here's a revolutionary new turret system, we're going to add all these technologies in there, and it worked really well. Now, the Zumwalt, I don't foresee working that well like the Monitor did, as the Monitor was born in a time of war, but the Zumwalt is still a necessary, they talk about the electric drive that the ship has. Someone brought up a good point that maybe this is a way for us to get back into the electric submarine game. It is a proof of concept on a ship, but diesel subs, electric subs are really, really quiet, and countries all over the world, many of them are peer competitors or not so peer competitors, are upping their sub game, and that sub game is going to cause a mess for a country like the United States that relies on sea control. So even if the Zumwalt itself isn't useful, maybe it is very necessary in the fact that it is giving us those extra capabilities we don't think we need. So at one point in time we said, hey, we don't need this kind of system anymore. Well, hey, we're bringing that system back. We're bringing these concepts back. And it's still next to useless, but maybe in the historic sense, it is something that we need.
Well, and Matt, you and Chris both touched on it. I mean, you just now, and then Chris earlier when you talked about JSF, you talked about derivative technologies and what you may be able to see coming out of DDG 1000. And I think that's the only benefit that we'll actually see coming out of it. You know, I mean, DDG 1000 was originally what, CGX, CG21, whatever, now DDG 1000. And, you know, Chris, you touched briefly with JSF, and I think a lot of people are seeing that, you know, JSF, a lot of the systems are derivative coming out of the F-22. F-22, you know, far and away, the best aircraft on the entire planet, probably 50 years ahead of his time, and I can say that being a proud son of a guy who worked at the plant there in Marietta, Georgia, building the F-22s. But the JSF got so much of its technology out of the F-22 that it was a lot cheaper to produce, even though I think we've all seen the bill. You know, it eventually became a lot cheaper than if we were to develop the technology just for the JSF platform. And hopefully, maybe eventually we'll see that the technology that is matured in DDG 1000 may have some lasting benefits to a different hull.
I think Matt's analogy to the Monitor was especially apt because it seems like both of them can't take quartering seas that well. So I think it'll be a lot of fun for the first crew sailor on that boat to experience the joys of, you know, 20 and 30 degree rolls, and a little bit of, yeah, I mean, I think that, you raise a good point, Matt, with, hey, I do want to clarify, I don't think iterative means no, surprises. So I think that iterative or no advances, it's kind of how big of a leap do we want to take into the unknown? And, you know, I think, That's how you should frame the question. Should we do something along the lines of, you know, jumping really far into the darkness? And is that what Zumwalt's doing? Or should we do more of a change from like an enterprise class carrier to whatever happened after that? You know what I mean? Very small incremental adjustments that still throw in some innovation. And again, the other reality we have to speak to is what's the environment that we're doing this in? I think right now, it's especially worrisome to take these really big, really expensive bets, seeing what's going to happen. And as SWOs, I'd like to ask you guys, I mean, how many fewer Aegis class and, you know, Virginia class subs are you willing to tolerate for this many more, which will be much less, Zumwalt and Ford carriers? That's the question I think we need to be talking about.
Great question. Matt?
Oh, thanks. Wow. All right. I'll just grab this hot. I don't know how the breakdown, and the calculus, would be, especially with sequestration. We can't even get guys into the shipyard anymore. Stuff's being canceled. Major hull work is being canceled. And now we're building new platforms. Chris, when you were talking about the iterative changes with the destroyers, we go back to that. And I think maybe now we're kicking ourselves in the ass because of that money issue. Exactly. That money issue, because now we're saying, oh, when we had money, revolutionary systems made sense. We said, oh, this is awesome. We'll chuck this money into the pit, see what happens, and then something will grow out of the pit. But I don't think we can afford that right now. But like we were saying before, can we afford not to? Because if you build a steady state force, if you secure your position, like Patton said, that I think, to paraphrase, fixed defenses are monuments to the stupidity of man, something to that extent.
Correct.
But that is in everything. That's not just defenses in the field, but that's talking about also your technology. Back in the day, I think about a year, 2 years, I don't remember how long ago, I wrote an article about drones, and I said the man who lives by the sword dies by the gun because somebody else has taken that iterative step past him, and can we afford not to do that? Because we can build as many really neat and focused versions of Aegis that we want. You can build those excellent sailing boats, and you can become the best sailing boats on the planet, but if you're the guy in sailing boats and the other guy comes out in steamships, you're out of luck.
And Matt, I mean, you hit it, you know, really good when you talked about money. And, you know, back in time,
that was Chris. Chris held up.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chris.
The little piece of paper with money written on it.
Oh, well, I mean, you guys are both spot on when you say, hey, you know, we used to have a lot of money. We used to have a lot of funds that we could use, you know, to whatever we wanted to. And that's not the case. We have to take a really hard look and see, one, can we sustain the force that we currently have? Personally, I don't think that we can. And two, we need to look at the possibility of we're going to have to downsize the force. How do we maintain what we currently have, the same influence that we have, and also the same combat power that we have? I'm not sure that building three multi-billion-dollar ships that aren't going to be able to do anything really for us is the way to go on that. I think the CNO had it exactly right when he said 2 weeks ago that the undersea warfare environment is the only area that we have complete and utter control over. Maybe that's an area that we need to continue to exploit.
True. You know what? I'm glad you brought up the issue of, sort of really put it into focus with the multi-billion dollar platforms. We're going to have an article coming out this week as part of our larger, Sacred Cows Week. If anybody hasn't heard about that, it's going to be things that we take for granted. Grant, I think you brought up a great point of something we take for granted. It is this multi-billion dollar platforms with really all these high-end capabilities. Can we afford them? Are they what they need? What we need? One of our writers is going to bring up an article talking about that quantity versus quality argument, and maybe we need to revisit quantity. It was a big issue in the Cold War is, you know, all the Soviet helicopters worked, and maybe the the SH-60s, they wouldn't all work, but most of them would work, and you would have that high-end capability instead of accepting a larger low-end capability. And that's how we've modeled our force throughout time, it seems, as we did concentrate on that capability on the take. Chris, you're laughing. Am I getting it wrong, or what? No? Okay, good. I didn't know if it was like he's just gonna let me walk Grant, into this pit of
no. Grant stuck his flag in the ground. You didn't say, you're gonna now be known as Ego because you waffled bad on that. You said we want more, but we also want to be cheap. Pick one or the other, man.
I'm not here to pick. Listen. When I write my articles, I pick. When I'm here in the podcast, I'm here ready to. And I'm not saying that's necessarily the case. I'm making the argument that one of our writers is going to make this week. So I'm a big, high-end guy, you know, space weapons, all that other kind of crap, but, you know, other people do have another point. And
that's an interesting perspective coming from a PC guy.
Listen, hey, PCs, that's a whole nother top. PCs, I think, are the best ships in the fleet, but not because of the capability, but because of the environment that they create and the kind of connections they create amongst the guys.
I simply think that's the environment that you create. You are the best XO anybody could ever ask for.
That is a good and a, well, yeah, and maybe great. Okay, I'm pretty amazing. We'll go with that. I won't argue with you on that one. But okay, so we've beat Zumwalt to death here. Not actual Zumwalt, but just the ship. Yeah, because we don't want to beat Zumwalt to death because he's awesome. Let's talk about, we had an article come out this week on the new Kill Cullen work. It's talking about the urbanized littorals. Chris, you had some stuff you wanted to bring up about amphibious capabilities. Grant, I think you had some points, so I'll just open the floor and let one of you guys start out on that.
I want Grant to start because I think he's probably I've heard of Kill Cullen's book. I've seen some synopsis on it, but I got to do a little quick research, so I'll let Grant kick it off.
Okay, great. So we were talking briefly earlier about amphibious operations and what essentially the fleet can bring to that. Now, I think what we need to define is first, what is the current capability of our amphibious operations? Back over to Chris.
So, okay, current capability, if we're talking about, I think how this got spurned was a guy on the Facebook site, I think it was Dan DeWitt, had posted the review of David Kilcullen's new book, Out of the Mountains. Full disclosure, haven't been able to read it yet. I like Kilcullen, as every Marine lieutenant does. You read Accidental Gorilla and you pontificate on it as if you're some type of expert, which I had done in the past. But I think the gist of what Kilcullen's saying in the new book is, hey, listen, guerrilla war is not done. It's just going to move into the urban areas. And he's looking at stuff like, Damascus and what's going on in Syria. I think he's looking at Libya and Benghazi and things like that and seeing how it seems to be that as humankind congregates along coastal, urban areas and coastal areas become increasingly urbanized, we're going to see fourth generation warfare move there. So vis-a-vis amphibious ops, I'm going to say right now, my opinion is we're not going to have a legitimate amphibious forced entry capability if we stay on the same glide slope that we're currently on. Maybe I'll throw some of you Navy brethren under the bus, but it doesn't seem like big Navy has a big interest in, their Gator forces.
Now I have to take some exception to that because we are building, the Marine Corps, essentially their own aircraft carrier in the version of LHD-6. You guys are getting your own, LHA-6. You guys are getting your own aircraft carrier, just for your own use that you'll be able to use, MV-22s, the Harriers, anything else off that. But at the same time, we're also building you two.
It's also called the America. That's pretty legit, yeah.
Oh, the America. I mean, anything that has America in its name is pretty
legit.
Yeah,
the Marine Corps gets its own aircraft carrier. It's called the USS America. I mean, you guys
probably. I mean, to be honest, it'll probably be called America.
Someone will go out off the back end and just slightly paint over that A.
Yeah, but on top of that too, we're also giving you, and Chris, you can speak on this too, I think a little bit, because I think a lot of our comrades from Kings Point and the other maritime schools are working on it, is the, a float forge staging base in the form of MLP. We're getting the, mobile, landing platform that is being built out of San Diego at NASCO, that is being specifically designed to be used by the Marine Corps to transfer, some pretty great capability from large ships to small ships and eventually the beach. So they're going to be building, I think the number is 3, maybe 4, of those ships, specifically for the Marine Corps to use. And then additionally, we're going to be using, I think the number was 1, maybe 2, of them for a float forge staging base to replace Ponce. Now is Ponce something that we want to go into and talk about?
Sure. Well, let's go into it.
Can I address a couple of those? So when I say, I don't think the Navy's, ignoring it completely and just letting it die. But I think as we sit, the last time I researched this for one of the articles on SimSec, I think we have something, 31, 32 amphibious, LH or anything with an A at the end of it boats. If you fudge the numbers really well, that'll get what our standard would be a 2 MEB, 2 Marine Expeditionary Brigade denied entry operation. be able to put two MEBs ashore. And that is using a lot of wishful thinking and rounding some numbers around in order to get those bodies on that number of ships. So whereas we are, again, I think we're getting back to our previous discussion, LHA-6, LPD-17, which is, a proven platform, although it had some growing pains, we're getting to the same thing of, A, we're taking numbers and we're trying to overcome it with some quality issues. And, to a certain extent, you're going to reach the point where numbers are not going to, numbers are going to be needed to some of these things. If you're going into a real bad days type situation like Damascus, Syria, it doesn't matter if you have the best boat on the water that's whiz bang and great and it's LHA-6 and it can carry, a squadron of, Ospreys and half a squadron of JSFs or Joint Strike Fighters or whatever. Because, one, SOCOR missile or whatever else is gonna really limit your options there. And so I think that numbers, there is a floor in terms of amphibious ships that we need to provide the capabilities we say as a Navy Marine Corps team we can provide. And as we build these more expensive Cadillac systems, we're gonna rapidly punch through that floor and hit a basement.
Grant?
Yeah, and that's an amazing point. I mean, I think that you're right. The number is either 31 or 32. The number that the Navy's been trying to peg, at least since I was a midshipman, was 36. And I don't think we've ever quite made it there. Even when we could make the numbers, the maintenance was always an issue on a lot of these ships and trying to get them out. And I think one thing that we can kind of see is, to Chris and, well, more, appropriately, Matt, do you remember what an ESG was?
Expeditionary Strike Group.
Right, Expeditionary Strike Group. Absolutely. We used to take three amphibs, typically an LSD and LPD, one of the old versions, and either an LHA or an LHD, one of the flat tops, and send them out. But we'd always give them destroyer cruiser escorts wherever they went. And so for a long time, we had ESGs. Unfortunately, now we're back to the concept of just amphibious ready groups, where you just send out the three amphibs alone and unafraid. And I think that really speaks a lot to what one, the stretching, of the commitments that we have for the current crewed S force and the Navy, portion of the fleet, but then also, what is our commitment to the amphibious side of the house?
Yeah, and there's another point to be made along with that is I think I was a huge fan of ESGs. One of my bosses was an ESG, Mew on the ESG S2. What we're increasingly seeing from the Mew side of the house, the Mew ARG concept is these guys are not, being a concentrated force. They're doing split operations with one ship, however many thousands of miles this way and another ship, however many thousands of miles this way. To cover down on more commitments. And, that's fine. But again, if we keep taking this model of, hey, we can have these really high end Cadillac platforms that do everything, they can't be everywhere. And you're going to run into a problem of, kind of diluting yourself down to irrelevance by doing that.
So, go
ahead, please.
Yeah. And just, our amphibious ships really aren't just exclusively amphibious ships anymore either. You kind of hit that with, what are we doing with the forces? Are they doing split operations? Are they busy doing, what's the most recent one that we did? Pacific Partnership. I think we're sending an amphibious ship now alongside with a hospital ship every other year, to do those kind of missions. We have them as floating hospitals. We have them as doing, HADR operations. So our amphibious ships really aren't dedicated amphibious ships anymore either. So that number really, when you take a look at it, just continues to dwindle.
Go ahead.
Sorry, let me ask a real quick question. What would either of you take as a cut to the sea control side of the house in order to maintain the amphibious side? I mean, again, I like to get down into numbers. What would we, and by a sea control, I mean, how much of a decrease if we're treating it as a zero sum game, would we be willing to accept in the Zelmaltz and the Aegises in order to have a 36 ship?
The way that I would go about it is that I would personally get rid of all of LCS. I would just get rid of LCS. I don't see a point. They have not proven it. The best that I would do is I would take the program, I would remove all modularity from it, and I would choose a few platforms to be dedicated ASW. and then you choose a few more to be ASUW. So I'd choose a few dedicated platforms, remove all the extra money on the modularity, and cut a whole bunch of them. Get rid of the frigates, because the frigates are dying. They're going to die. There's no reason to extend their life, so I can get rid of those. Stop having sailors training on the fire control systems on the frigates, because FCs do not need to take that to other platforms. It is not compatible with what they need to know. I would invest more into that amphibious capability and take some of those money and savings and put them into more destroyers. But that's in the sequestered environment. Is I would take all of that and I would double down on what I had now. Now when it comes to like actual development, where I would go with it, I mean, I think we're on the right glide path. Maybe we replace some of those projected almost, what we should probably consider is everyone talks about how many, because in for the rest of the world, they are super carriers. How many super carriers we have versus the number of amphibs that we have. Because amphibs still bring an important capability, and when you look at it, a lot of what we do is irregular conflict. Again, we sort of started this conversation talking about the urban littorals. Where are the fights going to be? The fights are not going to be necessarily with peer competitors because of the economics, because of that balance, because of those high-end capabilities that everyone has. Everyone knows that everybody can really ruin each other's days, and the people that we're combating with are not, I think, of the mind where they're suicidal. They know they can mess us up. They know we can mess them up. The ones that we're concerned about are the ones who don't have that calculus. And I think that the amphibious capability is the one that's going to help us there. As well as we talk about humanitarian operations, both abroad and at home. Because you look at issues like hurricanes, but that gives us a capability to help at home, gives us ability to help abroad. And we talked about, I think, in 21st century sea power, they talked about preventing wars as important as winning them, and a lot of the modern day irregular conflict, you talked about the ideological battle, about those global guerrillas who from Mumbai to Kenya already just wreck anybody's house. The amphibious capability is the one that's going to get us out there, get us boots on the ground, get us face to face with people, and give us the ability, if something happens, like let's say another Benghazi or something like that, it allows us to have that asset on station to put somebody on the ground. Because even if you have something like a Gerald Ford out there, all it can do is dump some strikes. Maybe it can drop a specialized team in, but it's not the aircraft carrier is designed to create a control of commons and striking presence. It's not designed for putting boots on the ground. It can do that, but it can only do that in a limited way. And then you bring these amphibs to the table, and you can put experts, you can put CBs, you can put Marines, you can put anybody who you want on there, and I think that gives us a lot more flexibility. End scene. I'm going to let somebody else talk now after all of that.
Yeah, sure. I've got, I think, five, actually, quick points. First, things that I would change to go ahead and help sustain what we've got now and also support the amphibious forces as a whole would be, one, kill LCS, kill it now, kill it quickly. Downsize to one combat system and import that over to HSV. That's a platform that doesn't get a lot of attention, but it should.
That's right. You know, I'd totally forgotten about that.
Exactly. And Joint High-Speed Vessel is a vessel that meets and or exceeds every critical performance parameter that LCS was designed to meet and does not, all right? And it is still only $200 million. Granted, that price will increase once we go ahead and put a combat system on it and such as that, but it's a great platform that we should really consider for use, because the whole idea of LCS was, one, make it cheap, two, make it expendable, all right? A $200 million platform with 30 guys on it is completely expendable, and I hate to say that for the moms, dads back home, but 20 guys on a ship, that's expendable. Same thing as an aircraft. You go and you take a look at LCS at $450 million to $600 million a pop with 110 guys, not expendable. All right, you're going to be writing a lot of letters home for that. So, yeah, take a look at JHSV as a replacement. Two, build more PCs. All right, and have them, you know, give them some capabilities. Thank you, Matt. You know, have some capability to support special forces. Maybe do some point area defense, but also be able to go head on head with other surface combatants. On the same lines.
Grant, sorry. If I could jump in on that one, that's kind of what I was getting at when I talked about pipelining LCS, is you look at LCS and you look, and I've discussed this with some people and had to come to some, like, unpleasant realizations, is I'd love to restart the PC production process, but that'll probably be more expensive at this point, maybe I'm wrong, than taking, like, the LCS 1 and slicing down those capabilities and saying, okay, we're now limiting you to this box, which will be a lot, at least in my view, possibly cheaper than restarting. But you can, maybe if you can speak to that. Sorry, that was all I had.
No. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, if we could, you know, find a way to make LCS strictly a PC, you know, perhaps a Corvette-type vessel, that'd be great. I'm not sure that we can do that simply because we have too much politics in play, honestly.
Fair enough.
Personally, I would love to go ahead and go out to the Danes, even the British, and buy one of their platforms, or even Oslo down in Australia. They make some great platforms that would be wonderful for PC replacements, but it's not going to happen because they're not built in America, unfortunately. But along those same lines, I think we need to get out of the MCM business. Just need to flat abandon it. Outside of the MH-53 helicopter, give it up and give it to professionals in other navies who are really, really good at that, and then pay for them to deploy to the areas that we're interested in and let them do that work. I think it'll save us a lot of heartache, you know, completely eliminate the training pipeline that we have for that, as well as the, 13 vessels that we have for MCM operations. It's an area that we're not very good in to start with. Other nations are better at, and we can save our money and do it better elsewhere. third point was get rid of the six-month standard deployments. A lot of people look at, you know, our deployments, and they're like, oh, 6 months, that's great. We'll build our maintenance cycle around that. We'll build our dry dock availability around that. We need to get rid of that standard, make it a nine-month deployment. What sense does it make to take 30 days to go over to a theater, 30 mm-hmm. days back, and so really you've only got 4 months on station? I think our sailors out there, the young men and women that we have serving in the Navy and also in the Marine Corps are, you know, by and far the best people in America. I can say that with utmost confidence. And if you tell them face-to-face, hey, boys and girls, you've got a nine-month deployment instead of a six-month deployment, but congratulations, you're going to be collecting more tax-free pay, I think they'll be okay with that. So we really need for cost savings to make it a nine-month deployment, because as it stands now, we've got guys who are deploying for 6 months but end up staying out there for 8 or 9 months anyway. Make the deployments nine-month standard. Build your maintenance cycles around that.
And, you know, you bring up a good point, and I think that's a message failure issue, because you brought it up yourself. You said, we say six, we do nine. Nine is the standard in many cases now. And if maybe you read that Navy Times article about, hey, we're extending deployments to nine, and the one lieutenant commander who brought up the fact, hey, it's like if I came into the office and said I needed you to come in for the weekend. Because you've got people who just don't get it. Either they haven't been on ships for 4 or 5 years and don't understand what 6 versus 9 months mean, or it's people that are unwilling to put their foot down and say, hey, I'm going to take the flack for extending this for the short period of time until we realize it's a better idea. But I think it's a message issue.
Is that a legitimate? I'm just surprised, because if that's a legitimate concern, because I know we've had plenty of Army soldiers and Marines that have been involuntarily extended, you know, upwards of 12 months. So I don't understand why that became part of the calculus where we had to justify to wives back home why that's coming out.
It's a luxury. The ground pounders have been in the suck a lot longer, and they've had to make the adjustments, and the guys in the fleet probably need to get used to that a little bit more, and in many ways they have, but that's really it. It's this mentality where it has to be done that way, and I really think that's what's going on.
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's justified, because there are guys out there that really get it a lot worse, but I'm just giving the reasoning, not necessarily a rationale for it.
Well, and outside of, you know, the emotions of, oh, hey, honey, I'm not going to be home for 6 months. I hope you can get along without me. And she celebrates. Go ahead and take a look at what goes into preparing any unit, whether it be Marine, Army, Navy, for a 6 month deployment. There is a lot of stuff. There's a lot of specifically for Navy, there's a lot of underway time, a lot of training time, a lot of maintenance, a lot of prep work that goes on. Now, if you can sit there and say, oh, hey, I'm going to give you 50% more time on station, all right, and really that only affects your maintenance by, 12 to 15%, I think were the latest figures that I saw, you get a lot more out of a 9 month deployment than you do out of a 6-month deployment.
Right.
And so I think that would really actually induce a lot of cost savings and allow us to also decrease the number of ships that we have. Cause, you know, we really need to take a look and see, hey, are we going to be able to sustain a 280 ship force? Is it going to happen? And, you know, just between us girls, I don't think so.
Us What's, girls and the rest of the internet.
Your define AORs. I'm interested in that one. That was your next point. I'm not trying to get us off this one. I'm just interested in what you mean by that.
Yeah, my next point for define AORs was, you know, I believe it was Admiral Mullen who came out and said that we need to have a 1,000-ship Navy. And I really understand what he was trying to say behind that was we need to bring in our allies and involve them a lot more. And I think at some point we need to take a look at our allies and say, hey, we can't do it anymore. We can't patrol every single square mile of the ocean. There's got to be different countries that take different areas of responsibility within the particular theaters. And so, you know, we need to sit there and say, hey, you know, Brazil, perhaps, you know, you guys go ahead and take Southcom. Africa, well, we're going to leave that up to, I don't know, India maybe. We need some help defining the AOR so we're not spending, like I said, a month going over to CENTCOM for 4 months on station and a month coming back.
That is a great point. When you have only like two NATO members spending the mandated 2% or higher of GDP on defense and there's the problem of free riding, I mean, it's like anything. You give something to somebody for free and they're going to use it and abuse it. You know, how good was the Xbox in any NWR you guys have ever been to? Probably not too great. You know, how great were the weight sets in the gym used by transiting units at Bahrain or wherever? Not that great.
The shoreside thing, I remember that. That was such garbage.
So that's what I'm saying is that when, as long that your point to that, Grant, is, I mean, this gets into some political questions because then it's like, oh, hey, France, you want to go do this intervention in Mali? Yeah, we'll provide you the lift and the aerial refueling and we'll do these things. So at some point, it's going to come the uncomfortable conversation where maybe we're going to have to give up a political ends, or I mean, policymakers are going to have to make that decision. But, you know, that's the only way that's going to get them to make the necessary investments, because we keep allowing the free riding to happen, it's going to keep happening.
You know, and that was the point, I think, of 21st Century Sea Power when it came out. It was like, hey, we're going to reach this awesome Navy or whatever the number they used was. But the idea wasn't going to be our ships. It was going to be our ships and everybody else's. And you guys are kind of talking exactly to that idea.
Yeah, I just want to know why it's so bad to ask people to take care of their own security concerns. I mean, that's apparently become a dirty word. Although we're the evil imperialists. I don't see anybody else stepping up to cover the gaps that are left. So I think Grant's proposal of, you know, ceding some of that responsibility back, so maybe we can focus on what's really important. And doing it in a way that we would totally support via exercises and military exchanges and complementary stuff would be great. Would be great and we'd be well suited, but you know, we're getting to be a rock in a hard place, and wishing stuff to be the way we want is probably not an effective means of operations.
Well, do you guys have any final points? We've been rambling on here for about an hour. I think now is an appropriate point to put a pause in our conversation. Got any final issues, final points, stuff you want to bring up?
Yeah, I just want to, again, get all those listeners out there, to our dozens of listeners, maybe fives and sixes of listeners, to please encourage you guys to get out there and really actively get some smart people in this organization. And I'm being facetious when I say dozens and fives, because it is amazing sitting in the chair here of membership director how much this organization has grown and how it's grown very organically through word of mouth. Just this last week, due to Mr. Greenwald here on the podcast, assistance, we got a pretty famous naval thinker on board. And we're continuing to do that. And it's all because of a lot of smart people going out there and talking and engaging and getting people to take note, because I think the things we got going for us is very dynamic, very creative means of addressing problems, and then really low barriers to entry. We're not going to turn anybody away, and we're gonna listen to what you have to say. We might write something calling you stupid later, but we'll still let you say it. So,
well, I mean, if you are a Nigerian prince and you wear clothes made out of newspapers and talk about how you used to be Napoleon, probably gonna turn you away. Just put that guy.
That's a good point. We do have some barriers.
We do have some standards. They're very low, but they do exist.
Very low. We're the University of Phoenix of defense, think tank.
Oh, wow.
but we do mandate that high school transcript to be certified. But otherwise, I do want to just push it out to everybody out there. Please, go spread the word, spread the gospel, get people writing, get people thinking, get them listening, because I think I put it on Facebook, but this is about the best group of young go-hards doing maritime thinking, that there is out there.
Yeah. And I was absolutely shocked. I was at, the world's most renowned institute for international relations, Fletcher.
Second.
next to what?
Georgetown. Come on. Step your game up.
If you're measuring it by who smells their own farts the most, then I think Georgetown certainly is going to be.
I'm outnumbered here.
Okay, all right. So I was at a very refined institute for international relations, and I was shocked to hear that they had heard of SimSec. And that's simply due to everybody who's listening to this podcast, anybody who goes and visits the website. I think we had over 1,000 hits on Wednesday. Just the website. Anybody who reads, writes, subscribes, whatever. I appreciate what you guys are doing. We all do. We hope that you continue to read and write. And just remember that we're all in this together. I can certainly tell you that, especially between me, Matt, and Chris, we are not the smartest guys out there in the maritime security arena.
I know.
You guys, yeah, and you guys really are. And we rely on your innovative thinking. So please just come on here and say what's on your mind, because more often than not, you got it right.
Anything you guys want to plug? Twitter handle, what have you?
CIMSCC.org. That's the only one I got.
Grant?
Nope, got nothing.
All right, everybody. This has been another episode of Sea Control. I want to thank Grant and Chris for joining us this week. Not that they really have to join us, because they're already with us as members of SimSec. You can find us at SimSec, C-I-M-S-E-C on Twitter, and www.simsec.org. Of course, tell your friends, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Xbox Music, and it's been a pleasure having you guys. Thank you very much.